Hey folks, this is Brandon Odo from EMSBasics.com, and we're trying something a little bit different today. We're going to try and do a podcast. Usually it's just me typing away, but we're going to try and talk about some things that I really need help with. And the topic today is EMS to emergency department interface, basically the process of how we hand patients off to the ED and how we can really try and streamline that. And I think to do it well, you have to understand what's going on both sides of that fence. And unless you've worked in both settings, maybe you're a paramedic who's also a nurse or a tech in the ED, I think it's hard to really get a good sense of that. So I've brought in a couple of friends to help me out. We have Jeff here, who is an ED nurse in a hospital not too far from me. He's staying semi-anonymous so he can speak more candidly. And also Dr. Brooks Walsh, who is a ED attending, and also the voice behind Mill Hill Ave Command, which is a very good blog focusing on pre-hospital medicine, and also Doc Cottle's Desk, which is more about emergency medicine in the hospital. But let me bring these guys on and have them introduce themselves. Brooks, are you out there?
Yeah, hi. Thanks for having me, Brandon. Yeah, I'm an emergency medicine doctor in Bridgeport, Connecticut, a community ED. We do have some residents, and we interface with a number of professional and volunteer EMS agencies in that area. I work at a level two trauma facility. We have full-time PCI. We have thrombolysis for stroke and in-house trauma surgeons. So it's, I guess I'd say, a medium hospital. And we see the full range.
Okay. And you have a background in EMS as well, is that right?
That's true. Before I went to medical school, I worked in EMS for about 8 years, mostly in the Northeast. I worked as a paramedic for five of those. And I worked in a variety of volunteer settings, rural, urban, short time for pure private service, doing some dialysis runs, et cetera, but also worked for a 911 and in-hospital service. So had a fairly broad exposure to a number of different settings.
Okay, okay. And Jeff, are you out there?
Yeah, I'm here, Brandon. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. Thanks for having me, Dr. Walsh. Nice to meet you today.
Hey, good to meet you, Jeff.
I am an ED nurse in the city of Boston. Like you said, I'm going to maintain some anonymity, stay anonymous to some extent so that I can, like you said, speak a little bit more candidly. I think we'll get into this a little bit. The reason for that is that it is kind of a touchy area, and I wouldn't want to say something that would offend anyone and cause them to stop sending business our way. So that's why I'm going to stay anonymously. I also have a background in EMS. I started off as an EMT, put myself basically through college working as a basic EMT in a 911 system in upstate New York. Over summer breaks, I did a decent amount of critical care transport in the Boston area. And since then, went on after nursing school to work primarily in ICUs, and I've been in the emergency room now for just coming up on 2 years. So I interface with a whole lot of EMS agencies, 911 and transfer agencies, and I've really enjoyed my time in the ER so far. It's kind of brought me back to my roots a little bit.
All right. Well, we've really got the three parties at the table then. We have the physician, nursing staff, and EMS, although you guys also have an EMS background, so you have me beat there. But I definitely want to talk about the reports that we give to you guys. And in most cases, the initial time you're hearing from us is probably while we're transporting a patient, and we call in over the radio or over the phone, however it's done in that particular system, to let you know that we're coming and give you the heads up. And I'm curious what you really want to hear in this type of report. We call it an entry notification around here. And I mean, I've been in the ED where you guys take them and you're rolling your eyes and you just don't want to hear it. So what is the actual information that you'd like to have from us at that point? And you know, what kind of format do you want it in? What do you not want to hear? And what is actually going to do to affect the decisions you're making prior to our arrival?
I can speak to that. I would say that basically a radio or even a phone notification the primary purpose of that is to serve for us to get the ball rolling, to get specialty services involved. So I need to know, is this trauma coming in? Am I going to need to call neurosurgery right now? Is there severe head trauma and you think that, you know, they need to go to the OR or something like that quickly? Or it could be something as simple as the patient sprained their ankle, but they're 675 pounds and you need me to get a bariatric bed. So that's pretty much what I'm looking for so that we can get prepared on our end.
So if we call in and you say we have a significant trauma, what's the process that it usually occurs on your end?
Do you want to speak to that?
Well, let's see. I think a number of times this goes through nursing first, unless they are calling. Well, even for the serious traumas, I only get this notification over the radio after the fact. It'll come into the triage nurse at my emergency department. I'll be notified by them. It's only if by happenstance I happen to be near the radio, I'll hear the patch, which is a lucky break for me. It gives me a heads up when the patient rolls in. Unfortunately, there's no direct to physician calling in our system, which I think really would give me a leg up most of the time with the trauma alerts. I think it does provide good information. A lot of stuff happens once the paramedics and the EMTs come in the room. A lot of stuff happens quickly. And having an idea of what's coming in, you know, the general status, the mechanism, the context, is it's very helpful to have that before the ambulance arrives.
I know that we do around here, but Brooks, in your area, is there a formal sort of protocol for trauma activation, certain criteria and certain sort of processes that are set in motion if someone calls in and say, hey, you know, we got a trauma alert or a code trauma or whatever you want to call it?
Well, like most processes in the emergency department, it's interesting because I know perhaps two-thirds of it, the nurses deal with another two-thirds of it, and another two-thirds of it is dealt with by EMS. And there's an intersection there, but sometimes I'm unsure of the other elements. EMS can call in when they believe a patient meets certain trauma criteria. There's two different levels, where they meet the top or the medium level of trauma. There is another screening with the triage nurses to see. They try and upgrade things that they believe may have been assessed as too low in acuity by EMS, or they I don't believe they downgrade too often, but there's a further screen when people arrive.
Okay. And Jeff, I know that you guys do have a trauma alert system. If someone calls that in, what do you end up doing before they arrive?
One of the primary things that we do at our hospital is assign them immediately an alias name, even if they're awake and talking and can tell you their name. Drawing their labs, getting everything going beforehand. As soon as I know that there's a patient coming, the EMS will give me, say it's an 18-year-old male. I'll pull the book, that's kind of our lingo for it, assign them an 18-year-old male, and I can page out the trauma alert. And that, you know, gets the trauma team who's up in the hospital dealing with their inpatients. They get notified, you know, before the patient even arrives to the hospital. So it's a nice little system. And then, you know, how long does it take to get the labs? Usually, hopefully, less than a minute or two. And that's a lot. You know, there's no registration distraction in the background, so it really helps us get everything going.
That's cool. So you don't have to worry about registering before they actually get anything done.
Correct. Same thing. We do the same thing with strokes and STEMIs and things like that.
All right. So what if we call in a stroke, or, you know, we're pretty definite about it? What do you end up doing with that?
Same thing. We'll assign them in the anonymous name, and we can activate our code stroke, and that brings neurology down. Just lets everybody in the department know what's happening. Lets us, you know, it just lets us prioritize what we're doing right now. Maybe wrap something up with another patient so you can be available in the 7-minute ETA or whatever.
Yeah, it's interesting. I've worked at two hospitals. During my residency, I was at Yale New Haven Hospital, and they have a fairly elaborate and well-worked-out system for the code strokes. Often the first indication that you're getting a stroke patient is when the neurologist shows up in the emergency department. They get the notification from the field before the emergency department staff does. On the other hand, where I work now, we get the notification, the nursing will tell me they're coming in with a stroke, and I'm the stroke physician. I am the team that greets them at the door. We probably should do something akin to what you're describing with the aliases immediately assigned, especially that probably would smooth things over. But registration is fairly responsive, so it's been a minor issue up until now. But for strokes, we really just get one nurse, one tech, and the emergency physician, plus any other students that are there that day. Not quite as elaborate as the trauma response.
So, but for both of you, the neurologist should be there in some kind of timely manner.
Well, I think where I work now, I think it's probably akin to many communities or places that rely on telestroke, in that you'll get the emergency medicine doctor, and neurology is available for consultation by phone or telesystem, but not immediately available in person.
So that's really if you're just not sure on the decision.
Well, that's pretty much for all of them.
Yeah.
But it's just how they'd run at different places. Jeff's system is obviously much more well worked out, but rather they have the resources in-house.
It's more urban.
Yeah.
Okay. So I know both of you work in centers that do offer PCI. So if an ALS unit is coming in and they call in a just for sure STEMI, what ends up happening before they arrive?
At my hospital right now, I generally meet them at the door and take a look at the strip and activate from the hallway. It depends. It depends a lot on the time of day when we can activate. Our cardiologists rely on some more screening during the wee hours of the morning, but they prefer a bit more speed calling from the field during the business hours. I think you'll find that a lot of places.
Our system, this is exactly the topic that made me think that I should do this anonymously, because the honest truth of the matter is it really depends on who's calling in this code STEMI. I've seen in my 20 months in the emergency room a number of, them calling in. This is absolutely a STEMI. We want to go straight to the cath lab. And we get there, and it's not a STEMI. It's a bundle branch block, or there's no reciprocal changes, and it's resolved, or something like that. So it really depends who's calling it. City of Boston ALS absolutely will send them straight to the cath lab. They don't even come into the emergency room. They go to a completely different door in the hospital. They basically pull up to the front door. Boston MedFlight, absolutely, we would send them straight to the cath lab. However, then there's your services that you don't trust quite so much.
So there really is an element of, who is talking to me and how much do I trust them?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I think that's interesting. I think maybe it's our EMS in our field is perhaps a little too reticent to call the STEMIs from the field. I think I've been more encouraging for them to alert us ahead of time. But I think it's also because we require a machine interpretation as well, and those tend to be fairly specific, and I get fooled by the EKGs about as often as the machine, so...
I can vouch because I'm in the same area as Jeff. All of those large Boston teaching hospitals, they have signed on to a protocol where, there is field activation of the cath lab by any paramedic, at least ostensibly. But in reality, what ends up happening is a lot of medics don't even know about it. And the ones that do often are hesitant to say, this is a code STEMI, because they don't want to be wrong. And it kind of makes it on them. So they say, well, we'll wait until we get there. And then, how long of a delay is that? And then the doctor will deal with it. And, the small delays end up adding up. So by the time anyone actually makes a call, maybe it's 20 minutes later, but at least they don't feel like it was their problem.
Well, you don't want to be wrong. I'll try to tell this story really quickly, but it's actually a pretty funny and true story, and it sort of speaks to why sometimes we don't rely 100% on that. I mean, and it's when you get to the ER, it's not even just one doctor in my system that's making this decision. I mean, the ED attending and the senior resident and the junior resident and cardiology is there, and they're all looking at the CKG too, and sometimes even they have a question about whether or not they're going to go to the cath lab. I had a patient one time we got this radio call that he was doing a STEMI, and they wanted to go straight to the cath lab, and they didn't work for one of the agencies that we trust, so we did not allow it. Patient came into the ER. The ST elevations had resolved. I guess there's some phenomenon where if you have high vagal tone, you can have this happen to you if you just have a vasovagal episode. Anyway, the patient later on in the day was telling me that he was so glad that we didn't allow them to go straight to the cath lab because his PCP had chest pain about a year prior and didn't go to the emergency room. He just called one of his friends who happened to be a cardiologist, an interventional cardiologist. And his buddy said, sure, just come on up to the cath lab and I'll just put you on the table and we'll see what we find. Anyway, so they get in there and they have clean coronaries and they're like, what's going on here? Well, they missed this guy's dissection, his aortic dissection.
Oh, Lordy.
Then it was such an emergency surgery that this physician had to go to the OR, and it was such a long cross clamp time that now this physician is a paraplegic because of this. And the patient that I took care of knew this entire story about his own doctor, and he was like, thank you so much for denying them to go straight to the cath lab, because he would have been an inappropriate cath lab patient too.
If it's, you know, 1 a.m. at, you know, either of your hospitals and you do decide to activate the cath lab, what kind of lag time are you looking at? I mean, how many minutes until they're standing in that room, you know, waiting to stick a balloon in someone's heart?
Well, even at my hospital where cardiologists are coming in from home, there's I think you're going to find this in most hospitals. This is an incredibly strong commitment to meeting the 90-minute door to balloon, and they will bust their humps and to get that done. And generally it gets done unless there's complicated circumstances regarding the interpretation or the context. It gets done night or day.
So, I mean, 20 minutes, half an hour, an hour.
Well, not 20 minutes. They do have to drive in, but it is a one call. Everybody gets notified at once. The emergency physician only has to call up the switchboard and nursing's activated, techs are activated, the cardiologist is activated. All these things fall into place. So it really does help speed things along.
I can't say is at my hospital. I could probably pull up the data, but I usually leave after I drop the patient off in the cath lab, and my personal best is 14 minutes.
Nice. Well, I will say there was a when I worked as a paramedic up in New Hampshire, we did the thrombolytic checklist. This is going back a few years. We did the thrombolytic checklist in the field, and we showed up in the emergency department, and we had a door to drug of under 10 minutes, which was very satisfying.
That's pretty good. Sometimes you can't get an IV in 10 minutes.
We were humming that day.
Now, so when we're out there and we're notifying you guys of these various resources that you're going to need, is there anything that you find we often don't think to mention, but you actually do, maybe it takes some time to mobilize, and once we get there, you have to wait on it?
I can think of one thing with stroke. I actually read a recent article in, I think it was Finland, looking at expediting EMS treatment of stroke. And they used a variety of interventions. And one of them was making sure that the members of the family who knew the last seen normal came with the ambulance. Mm-hmm. A lot of the times I see EMS being very speedy with the patient, but we're left with an information vacuum once the aphasic patient or somehow disabled patient shows up. And the rest of the family is en route and unreachable by phone. So I think some assiduous attention to that element, the people who can provide the context, provide consent in a stroke situation. It's a lot to think of, a lot to organize on scene, of course. I'm not ignorant of that. But being sure of onset and being sure that they know who is coming and who can speak for the patient.
I often find myself mentioning the need for translators, but it seems like that's usually sort of ignored. Often, if it's a common language, there's somebody around, and if it's not, they figure they could call them in later if they need them.
You just talk louder. That's usually what I do.
Yeah, slower and louder. All right, so we got the patient. We show up. So say we have a very sick patient, and we roll in there, and everyone's there to meet us. Who are these people in the room? I mean, usually we can sort of guess maybe somebody's a nurse and, you know, that guy over there with the coat's probably a doctor of some kind. But, I mean, typically what kind of team are you do you end up dealing with?
Well, I'd turn the question around on you. I'd honestly, not to be rude, but what does it matter? Because to us, we're all there together taking care of the patient. We know that we have the right team there. And, you know, there's a whole lot of overlap that happens there. But, you know, there's certainly nurses, doctors, techs. You'll get respiratory if it's necessary for a vent. You know, the usual people you would expect in the ER.
That's interesting. I do remember as a young EMT basic, I did a transport to a tertiary care hospital in Maine. And I think I gave report three or four times, and I never was quite sure who I was talking to and what they wanted to know, whether they wanted to know the GCS or the patient's social security. It was all a blur to me. So I think I have some... I think I know what you're getting at here, Brandon, and it's difficult because there's been some move to standardize how nurses and doctors dress in the emergency department. The techs wear the dark blue in our shop. The nurses wear the light blue. But it's a bit much probably to expect EMTs who are unfamiliar with the hospital to appreciate that when they come in. And everybody's looking for different information, it's true, with the with a STEMI, I maybe want to nail down exactly when the patient complained of the symptoms, when the EKGs were obtained, what interventions between these EKGs, whereas nursing may be looking for entirely different information. And I hope you can recognize registration in the room.
Usually they have the computer.
Like, yeah, clipboard.
Yeah, right.
But... generally, for most of our critical patients, someone who looks septic, someone who looks sick, or respiratory distress, will at least have one tech, one nurse, and one physician in the room. And sometimes it can be difficult to tell them apart, but that's our minimum team. Like I say, for the traumas, as pointed out, if it's a pediatric trauma, we can have two pediatric physicians, anywhere from three to four surgeons, emergency attending and resident. As Jeff said, the list goes on. And good luck. I have trouble recognizing who people are at times. It's especially for the pediatric traumas. It's can be a real melee at times.
Well, you know they work there because they're wearing scrubs, right? All right, so... We show up at your hospital, and this is done differently in different places, but often we initially will make contact with a triage nurse. And either we give our full report to them, and then we sort of get rid of the patient, or oftentimes we give them the basics, and then we get the patient to a bed, and then maybe we give a report to the actual covering nurse who shows up for that patient. But, I mean, in either case, what's the role of the information that we're actually giving to triage and that they're probably entering in as the, you know, initial note for that patient? I mean, who ends up reading that, and how does it affect the care, especially if we're actually directly handing over care to somebody else later?
I would say in our department that everybody is constantly reading the notes out in triage to see what's out there and what's coming in. There is a large void in that information, and it's really helpful when I do get the bedside report from EMS. But sometimes, as you know, it's really busy, and there's quite a delay for that patient to come back to their bed.
Yeah, it's sometimes I wonder what happens out in triage. Like I say, I know perhaps 2/3 of what goes on, and it's often frustrating because I know there's information being brought in by EMS. So it's one thing to talk about the stroke patient, the STEMI patient, the full trauma patient. I feel like we get fairly good information, a fairly complete picture from EMS, even in the absence of a written report. But it feels like there is a lot of information loss with these middle-of-the-road patients, the ones who aren't quite sick enough to get moved to the resuscitation room right at first. And since we've moved to a different process in the emergency department, the triage notes are often fairly short, often haiku length.
It is sort of an expanded chief complaint, really.
Which can be so frustrating when the context can be so important, when the patients maybe don't give the full picture. And You need that extra information that you can get from EMS, whether it's the vital signs, the simple interventions, or just what the house looked like that they went into. I don't have a good answer for that.
Yeah, I've sometimes found myself just lurking around to try and find someone who's actually going to be taking care of my patient, just because I'm not really kind of suspicious that maybe triage didn't get the whole didn't characterize things the way that I'm seeing it. Okay, so we show up. You're actually in the room to hear us for once. We're sort of unloading all this information we have on you. Is there any particular way you usually like to hear this kind of thing? Is there, you know, a certain format or anything in particular you want to hear? Do you want to hear all the negatives that we found? I mean, I know that you're going to end up obtaining a lot of this information yourself, probably, just because no one really trusts anyone. But, I mean, how does what we're telling you end up being used for your decision-making process?
Well, I think what I want to hear from EMS, and this is the same exact feedback I give my my junior residents, is I know you know a lot of information about this patient. I need to know the stuff that's going to make a difference right now, and I'll ask you if I need something else. Generally, a lot of the background history, the patient's medical problems, their physician, I can obtain so much of that through the electronic medical record for the majority of patients. I'm really looking for the things, the context, the setting, what happened tonight, how you found the patient, how they looked, who was there. Who called? What were the vital signs? What changed while you were with them? That stuff's crucial. And I find perhaps a little bit too much time is spent while EMS relates to me the patient's past medical history, which I find fairly easy to obtain in the majority of cases. I mean, obviously, there are patients that come in that were unknown to us where EMS can provide us with more context. But in general, what I'm looking for are the things that once the paramedics leave, once the EMTs leave, I no longer have access to.
Things you can't get anywhere
right.
else.
And even seemingly little things. Did the patient look sweaty when you arrived? Were they sitting on the floor? Were they sitting in a chair? These things really are what EMS is for, what we need them to what sort of data they can bring to us. It really proves their worth.
Absolutely. I would agree. Like I said, I feel a huge difference, and there's probably a measurable gap in patient care that occurs on those days that we're so busy that the patient sits out in triage for a number of hours. And I didn't get that report from EMS. I don't know what happened in the field. I don't know what their home looked like, all these things. I certainly prefer when I get a full report at the bedside on the patient versus, the brief triage note and they sat out there for 2 hours. I also feel oftentimes kind of snubbed. Some EMTs think that the only report they need to give is out in triage. And sometimes they'll come in and they'll drop the patient off and they'll just be like, well, there you go. I already gave report. See you later. And I'm like, well, hold on a second. Like, there's a whole lot that you can tell me that I'm not going to be able to discover on my own here.
Well, I think part of the problem there is half the time we end up finding nurses who just don't want to hear it. And I don't know if that's because they've got their own way of getting information and they don't want to waste their time, or they've dealt with enough semi-competent EMTs that they don't really trust what we're telling them anyway, or what. But I mean, it ends up being like, you're imposing on people sometimes just to get them to listen to what we have to say. And that is very dependent on where you are and, who exactly you're talking to. But I think it's a phenomenon we've all sort of
Oh, absolutely. And I feel so bad for that poor EMT that's just trying to make eye contact with someone so that he doesn't get charged with abandonment.
Yeah,
I do it all the time. I walk by head, straight on the floor. don't want anybody making eye contact with me because, they're going to, whether it's going to be the 95-year-old Gomer and roommate that wants me to help them, contact their long lost cousin in Alabama, or that poor EMT that just wants to give report.
All right. So we've transferred you our patient. All is good in the world. We go when we finish our written report in our personal, PCR for the patient, whether it's on paper or around here, they're mostly on computers now, but, we're supposed to give you a copy of that, or in our case, it gets faxed. But what ends up happening to this? Does anybody ever read it? I mean, does anybody ever care? Can it affect patient care?
Oh, that's a good question. I find them very difficult to. You mentioned you fax them. It's such a problem at both the hospital I've worked at, both the hospitals I've worked at in Connecticut. Getting that medical record, getting that patient care report into the record is extremely difficult. There's often a pile on the fax machine that only at some late hour gets transferred, maybe to the medical record. The data that comes out on those sheets is often very unfriendly to sort through in a hurry. It's often very difficult even to find the patient name. It seems to be buried halfway down page two many times, which is really unfortunate considering the criticality of the information. When I started as an EMT, it was the expectation that you left the run sheet before you left the emergency department. But this is, we were dealing with paper copies, so there was no other option. Yeah.
And half the time it seemed like those copies, I mean, who knows what happened.
Oh, and between the penmanship and spelling, there were their own set of comical problems with those run sheets. Yeah. But I just feel like there's another huge information vacuum with these run sheets.
Well, do you find that you could be taking care of a patient and you think, gosh, I wish I had this information. You go and try and pull that and actually see if it's on there, or is that just like usually not even worth trying?
If it's critical, I'll make an attempt to search the fax machine, the front office, but it's often in vain, unfortunately. It seems like still that first EMT to nurse, EMT to physician point of contact is the most crucial time.
So for us, we recently got the ability to see certain EMS providers' electronic records instantly, and I can't even tell you, it's incredibly valuable in some circumstances. I'd probably say maybe roughly 10% of the time, if I were to guess, but sometimes you actually do get information off of them that's very, very helpful, especially that patient that you didn't get the bedside report on. And since we've had that ability, which has only been a few months now, I find myself reading them routinely on the agencies that we can read.
Instantly, like it pulls up on
the
computer?
Yeah, it's linked right to the patient's medical record, and I just click on it, and it's there. It's awesome.
That's very cool.
That's excellent. I can't count the number of times I've looked at a run sheet and seen something like a disturbingly low blood pressure, or on the other hand, the times I've had to ask the patient, they put a little pill underneath your tongue. Did that make you feel? Oh, they did they? Oh, you chewed it.
Did they give you drugs?
I know we all have to chart a lot of kind of unnecessary stuff too, but the most valuable part of what they write is just their free text narrative, you know, with the actual useful information. I mean, I know we document a lot of things that are negative, you know, they don't have chest pain or whatever, but the narrative about where they found the patient, what they did for the patient is extremely helpful sometimes. And sometimes it's just as helpful because the patient insists that they drop their wallet in the back of the ambulance, and I call and find out, you know, can you just check? And then I can tell the patient that they checked, you know.
Well, that's what it ends up being at the time. It's mostly stuff covering our butts on, you know, one ground or another, and somewhere in there is maybe some patient information. But
so when are we going to talk about the real issue in the room, the patient med list that was always left with EMS?
And for some reason, it becomes the nurse's responsibility to deal with that. I don't know where that came from. I don't prescribe, but, you know, I don't know why that's my job, but it's certainly a big issue.
Well, somebody's got to do it.
Yeah, that's...
Or the times when we just got a big sack of pills from the guy's house, and we kind of wing that at you. I mean, does somebody go through and, you know, look at, especially when they're not even in bottles, you know, just like some blue pills and some red pills. Like, does someone try and figure
if it's
out
an overdose, we'll try to figure out what the pills actually are.
That's pretty much it.
Yeah. It can be frustrating when they bring in their pill minder for the week and you're supposed to sort through that, but a big bag of pills in their pill bottles, that's pure gold to me. I'll take that every time.
Absolutely. Always look through it. Try to record it.
Yeah. But it is interesting about the med list. This is from my time as an EMT basic through paramedic to working in the emergency department. It always seems like there's a med list with EMS, and they're always the convenient whipping boy once they've left the department. But I just wonder where all these med lists have ended up.
There's a med list demon who's just running around EDs and snatching
It has to be. It just has to be. I don't think EMTs are taking them home, unfolding all of these at home in their, when they get home, adding them to their stack.
Yeah, collection. All right, so we come from the MVA. You know, car hit a car, whatever. A lot of us seem pretty fixated on the mechanism and, you know, how fast were they going, and it hit him like this, and then there was this much damage to his fender here, and then there was like a little bit of intrusion in the compartment and this, that, and the other. I mean, to what extent do you guys care? Does this affect your actual decisions, or is it just kind of a, you know, window dressing to the story?
I would say it absolutely affects the decision-making process. You know, mechanism alone sometimes will get you admitted to the unit.
Yes, certainly, and I know the nurses out front are using various criteria that has been developed with the trauma service to when they assign patients to a level of the highest priority level trauma or the next lowest. I think you call it the trauma stat and the trauma medium. Whether highway speeds, whether there was ejection, whether there was entrapment, I think those criteria are still part of the criteria we use to assign someone to a acuity level. I think those things are important. I think there's a lot of the other information with the context, where patients were when you arrived, what they were saying, had they stood and walked, were they complaining of neck pain at the time? There's a lot of other context that's very important. I don't think that stuff gets missed. Most of that gets passed on very clearly. But
So less pure, you know, mechanics and more how it affects.
Oh, I think we're always going to look at those pictures recorded on the cell phone camera of how bad the crash was. Don't, you know, I mean, it's very interesting.
Yeah, that's good point.
I can tell you too that, you know, I worked in our trauma ICU for 5 or 6 years, and that information is the first thing that's reported on to the offcoming nurse, to the oncoming nurse, every single time, is what the mechanism was. And it stays with the patient sometimes for 3 weeks while they're in the ICU.
Yeah. It's interesting because there are the folks who view the mechanism as of central importance, and others who think that the physical exam, taking the patient, you know, examining them in the moment they arrive is much more crucial. I think all this is important, but certainly the larger context is something that only EMS can know, what this patient was doing, how they looked, what's changed.
Yeah, was it a horror show when you walked in there?
You're absolutely right.
It looked minor.
Taking care of a skydiver with no injuries and a fall from standing who died. I mean.
Yeah, exactly. Or if this patient was an ejection, but he got up and he ran from the police for half a mile before EMS managed to catch up with him. I mean, these the con.
Finish his gymnastics routine and, you know, did his stretching, his head turns.
The human capacity to withstand this stuff, it's amazing.
All right, so on the other side of the patient spectrum, we bring the patient in from the nursing home or the, you know, the skilled nursing facility, the rehab. Sometimes, you know, they come in with some sort of paperwork usually regarding their history and so on, but sometimes it's kind of cursory or, mm-hmm. you know, it's scrawled by a nurse whose pen is running out of ink or something. And I tend to imagine these are the kind of people who it can be important to get certain elements of their history, you know, how they've been recently, did they have their meds today or whatever. I mean, is there anything that you really wished we got in these patients that we often don't? I mean, I've seen you guys phoning back to these places to ask questions.
Well, I think the number one problem with the whole nursing home to ED transfer, I'm sure you're well aware of because you live it and I've lived it, is that it's often so hard for you guys to get a real report when you get to the nursing home.
Yeah, it's not my patient.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know. I just started here 2 days ago, that sort of thing. So sometimes we have to call them just to pin them down because, you know, you guys can't wait there for a half hour trying to figure out, you know, exactly what's going on.
I often find that one of the more helpful things is if I can find someone there, even if it's a CNA or the janitor who knows the patient and can really testify to their baseline. You know, is this guy can't, he's not really talking and he sort of semi knows where he is, but is he always like that? Or is this like, you know, normally he's playing chess and he's smarter than I am.
I got to say, I really appreciate when, you know, the EMT basics, the paramedics bring in a patient they've transported before and they tell me this is like it happened before, or he's really different. Not so much the secondhand. His wife says he's always like this, or the nurse says he's always like this. That can be tough once you get into that secondhand stuff. But I do really appreciate the firsthand, you know, the longitudinal care that you sometimes afford the nursing home patients.
All right. So most of these patients have all sorts of issues, complex histories, and those issues are followed at a certain hospital that they usually visit. And they'll usually request that we go there, but sometimes we are reluctant because it's a good distance away, maybe they're not too stable, or maybe we think that they really need a certain type of resource which is really available elsewhere. So how important do you think it is that we get these patients to their usual facility? And if we don't go there, how difficult is it for you to get those records of their previous care and figure out sort of what their previous history is by making phone calls, getting material facts, and that kind of thing?
That can be pretty darn difficult. In my corner of Connecticut at 2 a.m, you're dealing in an information vacuum at that point, and you go off scars on the patient, the bag of pills, the nursing home record that they send you with is gold at that point. It's Talmudic in importance. And this happens a lot with VA patients, for example. You know, they go to their VA for their 98% of their care, but if they're critically ill, they come to us. And, you know, you just – It's not the worst thing. You go off first principles. You treat what you see.
But then it's all the more EMS's responsibility to do the usual, you know, history and so on. Otherwise, you don't know anything more than we do.
I think in those cases, if they're critically ill, your history gathering is going to be limited regardless, and we're all in the same boat. Don't leave any papers behind. I would say that.
Yeah, I would say bring them to the hospital where they're known is probably invaluable. If it takes an extra 10 minutes to get there, unless you're doing CPR, you know, I'm not going to tell you to go against your protocols, but it's absolutely invaluable.
I'll second that. If they need an airway, they need an airway. But the quality of care actually really is affected by how much information we have on them before. I mean, it's hard to get away from that for anyone who isn't absolutely critically ill.
You say that's more and more true the more complex their history is. You know, the guy who's had, six bypasses in the past year or something, and they've all done by you, or he has an LVAD that you guys put in or something. I mean, that's...
Especially with the bypasses where they've had a complicated course with antibiotic-resistant organisms, whether they have a history of CVA or don't have a history of CVA, and forget the surgical history. With surgical problems, it's so crucial to go to the hospital where the surgery was most recently performed. I think that's actually... probably one of the more critical times to go to the hospital where they know them.
And maybe even the same surgeon can end up dealing with it.
That surgical service, they know the patient too, almost better than their family members do.
And the surgeons have a great sense of ownership over those patients, and they'll do what they can to get their patient back to them. So...
I would say at the end of the day, no matter what, those complicated patients are going to get transferred to that hospital. But if it's in the initial stages, if you can get them to that original hospital, that's absolutely helpful. But, you know, they're almost always, I would say 99% of the time, going to get transferred back to the hospital that knows them anyway.
Even if nothing else, it would be nice to spare everyone that trouble. But...
Sure. Especially the patient. They're so tired at the end of all that. Yeah. And you put them in an ambulance,
another
send them somewhere
ambulance
else
for you.
And start the whole thing over again. Yeah. Because then they get to the ER and, you know, we start all over. We redraw their blood cultures and everything, you know.
So what about not so much the hospital where the patient usually visits, but they say, you know, my doctor is with this hospital, meaning his PCP or maybe the specialist that follows whatever his condition is, but not so much the inpatient care as, you know, the guy that he sees, who is not going to be there when we roll in there at 3 a.m. But is that ever a useful thing to keep it in the affiliation?
For my end, not necessarily as important, because in my town, it's a two-hospital town, and certain physicians go to both hospitals, but whether the primary care physician comes to our hospital or not, it doesn't matter too much. If they have some medical records, that counts more.
Probably depends on the situation. You know, you get a lot of those patients that have these chronic medical problems, and you know, they're coming to the ER because it's either acutely worse or something like that. Say they've had abdominal pain, you know, for 6 months now, and they've been getting this workup as an outpatient, and today they decide to come to the ER. I'd say it is pretty important for them to end up at the same hospital, because then, you know, we can all sort of subscribe to the same treatment plan that's already been prescribed for that patient and go with that.
Yeah, sort of stick to the same plan instead of starting some new...
Yeah, and I mean, just, you know, it's probably selfish, but the amount of time it takes to get their records, and, you know, that's another patient, you know, who's just sitting there doing nothing while, you know, we're faxing HIPAA violation forms and everything.
All right, so you guys both worked in EMS before you worked in the ED, and there are definitely patients we bring in who it's clear that once we drop them off, their course of care is changing. You know, either everything is being escalated, or probably more often it's coming down a notch, or it's just taking a different path overall. Are there certain patients you guys think in general tend to be treated differently pre-hospitally versus in the ED? An example might be the C-spine patient who, as soon as we drop them off, you're pulling off their collar and clearing their spine, whereas we just spent a lot of trouble making sure that was immobilized, or, you know, things of that nature.
Well, I think when I look back, especially on my EMT basic training and then the paramedic, there was a lot of emphasis on the zebras, the critical zebras. And I think working in the hospital, you adjust to some of the not looking for the zebras, but rather recognizing the challenges and the longer-term subacute issues. And that's where our focus is generally. And we can recognize perhaps we seem blasé taking off the collars or reading the EKG, but we know there are plenty enough other problems lurking there.
We get a lot of patients that we're putting collars on that come in by ambulances, and I don't think that should ever be happening. I would say if there's any sort of traumatic mechanism at all, that those collars should be going on. They should probably be on the backboard. I had a guy not too long ago with an acute T2 fracture that came in sitting bolt upright in the bed by EMS, and I thought that was completely unacceptable. And I wouldn't feel as an EMT slighted in any way that we're clearing the collar immediately. It's just, you know, it's at the scope of practice of an emergency physician to be doing that, and it's at your scope of practice to be putting the collar on. I mean, if there's any sort of doubt, if it were you or your loved one, you would absolutely want to err on the side of caution, right? So just because we're taking it off quickly doesn't mean that you did the wrong thing by putting it on, or you should feel like you're disrespected because, you know, you went through all that trouble to put that collar on and we're just taking it right off, you know?
Yeah, we actually just started an interesting protocol at our hospital where we empowered the nurses at triage or when they get brought back to a room to remove a patient using spinal precautions, remove a patient from a backboard immediately on their arrival, just with all the problems with backboards, with pressure sores and difficulty breathing. The nurses have really accepted this. And I think I see it on the faces of some of the EMT providers that they've brought in a patient on a backboard and that the nurses are rolling the patient, removing the backboard so quickly. It's all very medically appropriate. And I think it all works to the patient's benefits. But you can see some of the dissonance in the pre-hospital provider's eyes when this happens so quickly. But there's no slight meant by it. It's everyone's taking the appropriate care.
Well, that sort of brings up its own thing, which a lot of the folks on the ambulance have had an experience where they're treating a patient a certain way, and we bring them in there, and often we hand off care to probably the RN, and they just clearly have a different view of things, either just the overall situation the patient is in, or even a specific treatment. This was coming up more, it's been a while now since it was an issue, but things that were more common in the field, like waveform capnography or even pacing sometimes, you bring them in and the staff were not as familiar with it or just didn't really, it wasn't really something they bought into, and they're just, they'd be pulling it off, or it's not really trying to maintain whatever it is that you've been setting up here. And I mean, everyone's got these stories, but like, is there a... What's the right recourse for this sort of thing? Should we just go and collar whoever looks like they have the most authority in the place? Or
That's a difficult one. You're talking about bringing a patient where you have some heightened level of suspicion for their illness or acuity, and it doesn't seem like it's registering with the emergency department staff.
Right. I mean, like you said, I think we are more alert for major emergencies than we necessarily need to be, and you guys are more on the realistic scale. But we do have these patients who, maybe it's something not obvious, like we're suspicious of sepsis or something like that, and we're trying to paint that picture, but maybe they're not really getting the painting. And you just sort of feel like they weren't really triaging in the right way.
I know that does rub a lot of EMTs the wrong way. And to be honest with you, there are certain EMTs that won't bring patients that they think are very sick to certain hospitals because they're afraid that they're going to be under triaged or that sort of a thing. Exactly. And, that's where things get a little bit... political, for lack of a better word. I mean, I would say that if you're really concerned that a patient's very sick, you can always ask to speak with the resource nurse and sort of appeal to that person as well. I don't know that anybody's going to give you a hard time for asking that. I mean, walk into the back like you're going to the ice machine to get yourself a drink and just ask to speak with the resource nurse. I don't think there's anything wrong with doing that.
I appreciate that perspective, Jeff, because I kind of wondered what happens out front there when there is this disagreement. They sort of come bundled to me. I would say that if it gets as far as me, I always appreciate hearing some data, some vital signs, some appearance, just your suspicion made explicit.
That's true, but on the flip side, intuition just can't be replaced. That's something I've been trying to tap into myself. as I get further and further into my career, I'm really starting to get that sort of sixth sense sometimes about the patient that's sick. And our hospital's actually validated this. We have a certain set of criteria, basically vital signs, and with trauma, it would be mechanism. And all of these times are times that we escalate the level of care and we get the team to the bedside immediately. And it's been shown in our hospital that our codes have decreased by, I don't even know, probably 90% fewer decrease in codes because of this program that they've instituted. And one of the criteria, there's like the heart rate less than 40 or greater than 130, the blood pressure less than 90, and so on and so forth. But one of the criteria is just nursing concern. And that nursing concern, these patients that reach that are what we call triggered because of nursing concern, have just as high a rate of admission to the ICU as any of the other vital sign parameters. And I think that if you get a seasoned EMS professional that has that same intuition, that same concern, I think that's also very valid. And if they feel like the patient's being under triaged and being sent to the waiting room, and in fact they, have a brewing sepsis, I don't think anybody's going to give them a hard time for just, appealing to another person in the department.
No, I agree 100%. If I have an experienced EMT basic who tells me they just think this person looks really sick, I actually take that very seriously. I think it's tougher for the newer EMT basic who hasn't built up that level of credibility, which is a difficult position to be in, building up that experience.
Absolutely. I think back to when I was in EMT basic and things that I thought were like, you know, the world was crashing down. Thinking about that now, I can't even believe I thought that about those things at the time. You know, I used to get the 21-year-old female in our service. I was an EMT for maybe 3 months or 6 months or something with abdominal pain. That 21-year-old girl immediately thought it was an ectopic for no other reason. Just she was 21 and she had abdominal pain.
Well, did she?
No. Okay. She never did. I'm just using a gross example. I mean, it certainly is in the list of differential diagnoses, but it's probably way down at the bottom, right?
No, there was a great study. I forget out of where. Anyway, they asked EMS what their suspicion for sepsis was with given patients. Or rather, they looked at the run sheets to see that the EMS provider's use of the term sepsis or concern for infection. And the funny thing is, I don't believe in the system they had a protocol that had any special education directed at recognition of sepsis or treatment. But EMS was able to label these people fairly efficiently. So I think there's a huge role for that intuition, that that experienced eye telling you sick, not sick.
Well, so what in the longer term, I mean, hopefully we sort things out in the short term, but if we really feel that there was a true error made with a patient that we brought in, I mean, there was a case I recently witnessed where a medic crew brought a patient in who was a cardiac patient, pretty unstable, but it was the ED read it as a case of VTAC, and they cardioverted him a number of times and hung amnio and some other things, and the patient ended up coding there. And the medics felt that it was clearly sinus tach on the monitor with a bundle branch block, and that they were really unimpressed. We managed to sort of shuffle out the most alarmed of them, but I think they went back later and he called the attending a murderer. So that's probably not the way to handle that. But I mean, if he really wanted to sort of raise it with somebody, is there a politic way of doing that? I mean, I know you guys have your own kind of M&M and kind of quality assurance processes, but it's often kind of opaque from the outside.
First, I've got to ask, was that at our hospital?
Well, it was not.
Okay, thank you. Well, there's, you know, in the heat of the moment, I mean, you know, that's nothing that you can teach. I think that's just basic human communication and dealing with conflict. In the after effects of that, there, I think almost every hospital probably has an EMS liaison that you can always contact, probably by following your chain of command in your own company.
Yeah, that's what I'd suggest at our place as well. The EMS coordinator is very responsive, I think, to EMS, and we are in constant contact with him. And frankly, if EMS thought there was a big disconnect between their impression and our impression, I'd love to hear about it because it's a great topic for education or discussion in the future. Gosh, you know, VTAC versus SVT with aberrancy, that's a tough one. But I've seen this before, too, the decisions we make about whether or not to activate the lab, whether this patient deserves TPA for a stroke. There's a lot of opportunities for misunderstanding or for education and discussion.
Yeah, it would be nice if there was more of an avenue for communication on that kind of thing, just so people don't walk away thinking the other side has got something wrong with them and, you know, can't come to any common ground.
Well, we have a lot of EMTs and paramedics from your company, Brandon, that actually come to our M&Ms, and they do have a modality for participating in those cases. There's actually probably more EMTs and paramedics from your company that come to our M&Ms than our own nurses go.
Taken over. All right. Okay. So let me just throw some different patients at you guys. We bring these people in there, and I think we sometimes have some idea of what happens to them, especially if we stick around for a few minutes. But, I mean, maybe not kind of the whole picture. So if we roll in there with, say, the presumed drunk guy that we found on the corner. You know, the man down, he says he had a couple of beers. Nothing obviously wrong with him. What do you end up doing with this guy?
Jeff?
well, Early blood sugar, of course, all altered mental status. Unfortunately, yeah. I don't think I'm making anything up here or saying something that nobody's experienced before, but some EMS providers fabricate some vital signs, and I've seen it happen, including the blood sugar, and we always check the blood sugar. I've always said that it's the drunk patient that's going to be the one that takes your license away from you, just assuming that they're just drunk. The fact that they're drunk puts them at such a higher chance of having something seriously wrong with them, on top of that being drunk or something else mimicking that patient being drunk. You really can't let your guard down with those patients. So my personal practice is I check their blood sugar. I take them out of their street clothes entirely and make sure that they don't have like a gunshot wound in their back or something like that. But it's so easy to get jaded. And that's the classic example of the patient that if you let your guard down, it's going to come back and bite you and take your license away, and you're going to lose your livelihood and your, mortgage, and everything's going to go away because of that one patient that you just assumed was drunk.
Well, so how far do you take that? I mean, you're not doing head-to-toe CTs on these people and admitting them for 3 weeks,
No, but also we're not just assuming that they're drunk and sticking them over in the hallway and, waiting for them to wake up.
Yeah, I agree 100% with what Jeff is saying. And I think it's ironically with these patients that maybe to the EMS provider who sees them and brings them in the field, who has a presentation that's entirely consistent with their past presentations, found drunk, sitting on the same bench, same as last time. When I see that patient in the hallway, they're a patient I have no history on, no run sheet. I'm not expecting to see a run sheet. And the triage nurse has a very abbreviated history about how this patient came in. And that's the time – right. And that's the time I'm crying out for more information from the field. They certainly get a thorough head-to-toe from me. Can't count the number of times I've found suspicious bruises. There's a emergency physician, Corey Slovis, who says you're not just drunk until you've had a blood test, an EKG, and a CT. Then you can be just drunk. I think he overstates it, but that is a time when I feel that I could use more EMS context, and it's the time when I think it's least likely to be found.
Yeah. All right, how about this guy? The just run-of-the-mill, maybe older guy, took a mechanical fall, maybe a minor MVA fender bender. We've got him boarded just precautionarily, but no major complaints, maybe a little bit of neck pain, head pain, vitals are good, nothing really alarming. We bring them in. What do you end up doing to these people?
Well, I think the majority of them get a good physical exam. I think with these mild traumas, they're often the more interesting ones. The ones who are ejected out of the windshield, I can tell you right now what they're getting for imaging. It's the smaller ones, especially the younger patients. We have to think really hard about whether we image the neck, whether they need a CT of their head, whether there's some medical context as well. They're far more interesting. There's no usual patient in that area.
So it really comes down to your clinical decision-making process. Do you actually think there's something wrong here? Do you think it's very low risk, that sort of thing?
Yeah, and again, it's the EMS context. If they were walking around after the fall and you had to convince them onto the board and they weren't complaining of neck pain until after the 30-minute transport, I feel differently. And then you showed me the picture of the car that rolled over three times that they walked out of. Nonetheless, that sort of information, those data points are hugely important with what I do with that patient. The severely injured patient, it's almost not as important.
So, okay. Well, what about the serious one? The guy who got ejected and now, his vitals are kind of a mess and he's semi-responsive. What's the kind of stock trauma process that you go through with these people?
I would say that the patient comes in, one of the most important things, one of the most valuable things that we try to do is to let EMS get their report out. again, that's sort of politically motivated. You were saying, Brooks, you pretty much know what's going to happen to that patient. They're going to get scanned from head to toe, you know, manage their ABCs, of course, not in that order, but, you know, they kind of go through a protocol-driven treatment plan. A lot of the trauma care for the severely injured patient is, you know, we all train for that, we know that, versus the not-so-severely injured patient. What's really important to us is that we let that paramedic or EMT get their report out, because honestly, we don't want to piss them off. We want them to keep bringing us patients. So that's something that we really try to do. And, you know, there's a reason for it as well. It's not just the politics. The truth of the matter is you can't let people get complacent to what the paramedic has to say. They do have extremely valuable information that is going to affect how this patient is managed. And we do need to hear it. So you can't just let that, you know, second year surgical resident start talking over the paramedic. We really do need to hear what's said. Once that's done, I actually appreciate it quite a bit when that paramedic sticks around and stands over next to the person who's recording about the trauma and watches what happens. Because what I see in that paramedic is somebody that wants to know what's happening to the patient. They actually care about what this person is going through. They're trying to learn on their own behalf, you know, what's happening to this patient. They're observing and they're realizing what they did and how that's helping the patient, and maybe what they can do better next time, maybe that what they did well this time. I think that's really commendable when that EMS provider sticks around afterwards for, you know, 15 minutes or so if they can, and sees what happens.
Yeah, I agree. Actually, at the level one trauma center I trained at, it was God help the surgical resident who interrupted the paramedic giving the report. The trauma attending demanded that the room be silenced while the report was obtained. And I've tried to adopt that same mentality. And like I say, it's very important to have the paramedic stick around, because there's always a second question and third question and a fourth question for them as the exam proceeds and new aspects are revealed. Perhaps I didn't hear it right the first time, I'll fully admit. It's valuable information.
All right. So we come to sort of a difficult issue. Over the years, there have been many conflicts between men, you know, Hatfields and the McCoys, dogs versus cats. EMS versus nurses has got to be up there. And I don't know why it is, but there's some kind of natural antagonism here. Whether it's a nurse in a facility or in the ED or up on a floor in the hospital, or probably if we ran into them in the street. But, I mean, Jeff, I don't know. How can we get along with the nursing staff? I mean, what is it that you guys sit around and complain about when we do it? I mean, what can we do to make your lives easier? What do you think we're doing that we're doing wrong when we do it?
Oh, that's a tough question to answer too. I certainly have been on both sides of the fence. I remember like it was yesterday. It's been a decade since I worked on a truck, but I still remember as this, you know, self-admittedly, you know, not experienced. Maybe I did a whole lot of over-triaging myself, and I still thought those nurses were idiots. I don't know why. I was an EMT basic. I was like, you know, 19 years old, and for some reason I thought that, you know, Lorraine, who's been a nurse for 30 years, is just an idiot. I don't know why I thought that way. And then now I'm on this side, and I don't personally think this way about EMS, but because I've been there and I see it from their perspective as well. But there's certainly a whole lot of nurses that think the same thing about EMTs. I don't know if there's some jealousy component or something. Everybody's a little bit jealous of each other's jobs, right? I mean, you guys get to work outside. There's a lot of great things about your job. You have more time probably than we do. And then you guys are jealous because you think that we probably don't do a whole lot, that we make, like, you know, honestly, probably three times what you make, you know, and that's not fair. That's not right. I know you guys deserve a whole lot more than that. I think that's one factor in it. And then like anything, there's a whole lot of bad nurses out there. There's a whole lot of bad EMTs out there too. Well, I like to think not a whole lot, but anyway, everybody that one EMT that rubbed them the wrong way, that did the wrong thing, that made the patient worse, actually, more so than they helped the patient. Those, you know, you remember those situations, right? And you start to learn to not trust people. So I would say, number one, absolutely, you need to stay professional with each other at all times, and you know, realize that everybody's there just trying to help people, right? We all went into this for the same reason, which is try to help people. I know that sounds really corny and cliche, but it's true. I have never met a nurse, EMT, doctor, technician, or something that went into it for the money. I just simply haven't experienced that. And I think that just remembering that is probably crucial, and just having the respect for each other. It's a tough question. I don't know why people treat each other poorly. I honestly think, seeing it from my perspective now, I honestly think it's probably a little bit worse from EMS to nursing versus the other way. I think most nurses, with the exception of a few, don't really have much trouble with EMS and generally respect them and are nicer to them, more so than the opposite.
Yeah, I think often the nurses are more or less professional, but at the same time, I think that they're often at least somewhat dubious when they first meet us. Maybe because, half of the EMTs or even paramedics they run into may be in their first 6 months of the job. I mean, the turnover is that high, so they may very well be very new. And even the guys who have been around may either be borderline competent or like they burned out a long time ago, so they just don't care anymore. So, I mean, there are the bad ones, and you kind of gotta, I don't know, I guess we should all be assuming the best from the start and letting people fail you over time, but it could be hard to do after a while.
You know, like any other business, relationships matter. If you've seen the same paramedic for years, you worked with the same nurse for years, you've got that relationship, and all these things become smoothed over. One of the reasons I really love emergency medicine is maybe back in the old days, all the neuro doctors were men and gray-haired, and all the nurses were women, and all the ambulance drivers worked in funeral homes. But now it's
and had excellent mustaches.
There you go, nice white smocks. But now it's so much more common. You have the doctors who came from, you know, EMS or nursing. You have the nurses who also work on the volunteer squads. Maybe that reflects more of my rural bent. You have the nurses who are getting their APRN and are starting to see things from a provider point of view in a different way. We have all these people essentially, you know, bridging their fields, and I think it's a great sort of melting pot for perspectives. I think it really points to, you know, you depend on people, you turn to people for their capabilities, not their title. I think that's so true in emergency medicine. You just can't count anyone's opinion out, whether they're a basic, a new nurse, an old nurse, a new doctor, or what have you. It's a great place for opportunities for relationships.
The other thing in emergency medicine and EMS is that most people, like you said, are building their careers. Even our attendings, right? As an attending, you're probably doing this. You're looking forward to the next thing you're going to do in your career. You probably are hoping to not stay at the bedside forever, or at least have something going on the side. Most people in EMS and in nursing and in medicine are all trying to build their careers. It's always a stepping stone. And you do have a whole lot of people that are at different transitions in their life.
Yeah, just because somebody is the paramedic now doesn't mean they won't be the nurse later, or the janitor later, you know.
Oh, that's right. Gather the hay while you may.
Yeah, that's going to happen to you if you assume that guy's just drunk.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, there probably are. There probably are some cultural truths about some generalities about the culture between nurses and paramedics or EMS, but I think the relationships are far more important than that. I think I see that day after day.
Yeah, I always figured it was, at least in part, because we are actually pretty similar. I mean, we play similar roles than a lot of these patients. We have sort of the same skeptical view of the world a lot of the time. So it's more of a almost a competitiveness sometimes. Gosh, we've been going for a while. We should probably try and wrap this up. Any kind of parting thoughts?
I can start off with that. This is something I've been thinking for a while, that we were going to do this interview. The truth of the matter is that good EMS really does make a difference. And don't let your guard down. Do the right thing by the patient. Follow your protocols because they're there for a reason. Be respectful of one another. And it's really going to improve your system. It's going to improve your relationships. And at the end of the day, it's going to improve the patient care, which is what we all went into this. I know that sounds so corny and so cliche, but it's absolutely true.
Yeah, I'm going to agree with that. It's easy for EMS, especially the new EMT basic, to feel like they're a simple cog in the machine. It's such a crucial role at times, and you can't predict when. And so keep working, keep asking the questions, keep giving us the data, stay involved. You're helping.
Yeah, I mean, it almost seems like being a cog in the machine is really the goal, you know? Be part of this this connecting chain of care, which actually connects. It's almost nice to just to have conversations like this, even if not a whole lot of profound answers fall out of it, just because we can really see how everyone is trying to do the same thing. We're all kind of on the same team, and the challenges and the things that we're doing at different stages are not really that different, just some different environments and different tools. But I mean, if we can all try and kind of play along nicely and work towards the same end, then things might work out. In any case, I think that'll do it for today. Thank you both for joining me. And to everyone listening out there, if you liked this format, if you think we should do it again, let us know. Drop us a comment, an email, or hit us up on Facebook. I think it's been pretty fruitful, but I want to know what you think. And until next time, this is Brandon Odo from EMS Basics, and take care of yourselves.